Aisha Tyler has got a new book out, Self-Inflicted Wounds. She's everywhere. Aisha is. There's nowhere she isn't. Let's find out all about it. She's in Los Angeles right now and taking a brief pause from all her activities. You're everywhere, Aisha.
I don't know how to answer that other than to say that a couple of those people might be RuPaul or perhaps Tyra Banks. I would do fair striking with them.
I can't see that. RuPaul, maybe. I guess a little close.
Yes, right? RuPaul, maybe. Absolutely. We're like doppelgangers. We often sub for each other, you know, in line at the Starbucks.
I bet. So you're in Los Angeles. Well, that's your home, of course, Los Angeles. Are you between gigs right now? Because you're doing Whose Line Is It Anyway? And The Talk and Archer. And
yeah, this is, well, I'm not really between. Yeah. The between is very narrow and cramped for me. But this is a miraculous month, August, because The Talk is 11 months a year, so we don't shoot in August.
Oh.
But I'm still making Archer right now. Yeah. And Whose Line, we shot already, but it's airing now, so I'm promoting that.
Yeah.
And I've been on a book tour. The book came out a few weeks ago, so I've been on a book tour. This is a really exciting month because I've been getting 7 hours of sleep instead of four.
Wow.
I'm delirious with rest. I don't know what to do with myself. I'm punchy. I want to hug and throttle people at the same time. That's how delirious I am with this extra sleep I'm getting.
I think you would be dangerous with rest. I think
I would. If I had a full night's sleep, either I would like cure cancer, or it would be like a beautiful mind where I just covered the walls with numbers that meant nothing, but I was like really engaged, you know, and like geometric shapes. I've invented some kind of new coffee filter that doesn't actually filter the coffee out, but just turns it into a terrible slurry. A lot of good ideas that go nowhere. That would be what I would be giving you with them, which is not unlike what I do when I'm not well rested. So
yeah, it's a heady thought.
It's a heady time for me. Yeah. Exactly.
Can I just try something here?
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Lana.
Keep going.
Lana.
Uh huh.
Lana!
Yeah?
Thank you.
Okay, you got to commit to the whole thing.
Yeah, I know. I undercommit. That's my whole problem.
It does uncover some universal issue in your life.
Yeah, definitely.
If you'd given me a one additional Lana, I would have given you a what. This is literally the mantra of my entire dating life, because if you had just given me one more, I would have responded.
And mine as well. That's my... It's really... You know?
Yes.
Probably why we never dated.
We're in the middle of making season 5 of Archer.
Archer.
I think I just recorded maybe episode 503 or 504.
Yeah. How much fun is that to do?
Oh, the best. You know, it's just a brilliant show, and I say that in the most self-involved and effective way possible. I just love it. But even if I wasn't on it, I would love it. And I don't think any of us ever – I didn't even think the show was going to get on the air. When I read the pilot, I thought, well, this is too smart and funny to make it onto television.
Yeah.
And so I thought, well, we'll just make a funny pilot, and then I can show it to my friends, and I've got them cornered and a little intoxicated. And now we're starting season 5, and it's just extraordinary. I'm really proud of it. It's the finest show that my mother cannot bear to watch.
Anybody's mother probably couldn't bear to watch that.
There's a mom out there somewhere who is like a cool. There's some cool mom somewhere who's watching Archer, or maybe she just has really poor decision making skills and probably shouldn't be parenting.
Yeah. And probably what you think maybe the strongest female cartoon character of all time.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. I don't think there's any challenge to that.
No, she's very strong, as is evidenced by the fact that she's double wielding AK-47s. But whatever she doesn't have in muscular strength, she'll make up for with intent. But she's, you know, I mean, the great thing about these characters, I think why people like this show is, even though it's about spies, Archer is at its core an office comedy.
True.
You know, I mean, it's a workplace comedy about a bunch of spies who have like no impulse control, drink during the day, sleep around indiscriminately, and occasionally shoot each other in the foot. And everybody's wanted to shoot someone they work with in the foot, I imagine, at some point.
Yes.
So everybody can relate. I mean, obviously our behavior on the show is very extreme. But, you know, there's also this kind of odd affection that you get for people in your office that drive you crazy and at the same time are super fun after they've, you know, done a bunch of shots at the company party. At the very least, they're good for a picture for your Facebook feed, which I understand that you feel you're not in enough. So maybe more office parties would get you in there.
I bet you're in your news feed. You're the one person who would be in their own news
feed. I just
feed.
Only look at my own news feed. Yeah. I only look at my own posts.
Yeah.
It helps.
Yeah,
people are like, don't you know that we moved and our kids are in college? I'm like, I don't look at your Facebook posts. No, you have to address me directly because yeah. I think with Facebook, as with Twitter, 99% of it are comments about what someone's had for breakfast.
Yeah.
And that's just not interesting.
Yeah. You're also in video games besides all these other things, right? So every form of communication is covered by you.
I have a paralyzing fear of not working. You know, I came from a working class family. My father is from the old country, as he would call Pittsburgh. And, he grew up in a time, you know, I mean, Pittsburgh is what Detroit aspires to be someday. If three or four more buildings shut down, at least when he was growing up. And he just, you know, he just was this hardworking, he still is this very hardworking guy, and I just came up with this work ethic where as long as you are awake and facing forward and at least one of your eyes can focus, you should be working. And I love to be this busy. I'm very grateful to be this busy. I do remember a nice period of time when I was doing things like taking a lot of acting classes and making layer cakes from scratch. I don't intend to go back to that part of my life.
Yeah.
I could make a mean chocolate mousse of sitting at home at day watching 9 hours of Nickelodeon Junior. So I'm really quite happy to be this busy. And I have a new video game coming out this fall called Watch Dogs, which is about surveillance and hacking, pretty much just a documentary game about PRISM, about the PRISM program. So it should be fun for everybody.
Excellent.
Spy on yourself.
Will it be a Balls of Fury, too? That's what I'm waiting for.
What, shouldn't there be, though?
Shouldn't there be
a Balls of Fury, too?
I love that movie.
Me, too. It's become this kind of odd cult hit. When I read the script, I thought, well, this is Enter the Dragon with ping pong, which would have been the only way to improve Enter the Dragon, really. And I got to wear this kind of crazy. I got to spend time with Christopher Walken.
Yeah.
I spent every day with Christopher Walken, which turned me into more of an insufferable nitwit than I am normally. And I would come home every night to my husband and go, well, Chris said this, and Chris did this. So I was really no fun to be around. But Christopher Walken is an amazing person.
Yeah, I imagine.
He would tell stories about, you know, like De Niro and Pacino when they were in their 20s in New York, none of which I can repeat here. They're not safe for public radio in any way, mainly because all the words are too short. There aren't enough syllables in any of the words he used for public radio. But,
and no matter what he says it like Christopher Walken. And he can't.
Well, that's good. Well, because he's Christopher Walken, so that it comes out that way. But he was just fantastic. We were both in drag for this movie, if people have seen it. He played this kind of Asian crime lord, and I was his bodyguard. And so we were both dressed like gay 4th-century Chinese emperors.
Perfect.
And he was fabulous. And he had red nail polish, which he would wear all the time, even when he wasn't working, which was so much fun for people to pull up.
Well, he's a character actor.
Yeah, he is. He's super method.
Yeah, he's method.
Yeah. And he would kind of help me around. It was like House of Blue Leaves or something, or Madame Butterfly every day, only with a lot of potty jokes. It was really a delightful time.
And then also aggressive
ping pong, which how can you beat it?
Yeah, yeah. Not just to focus on him, but I just happened to see Annie Hall again with a young Christopher Walken in there as a crazy brother, you know.
Yes.
Who wants to pull in the traffic on the highway, you know, when he sees the lights coming.
I think the most pertinent thing that is apparent here is that we should always be mentioning the films Annie Hall and Balls of Fury in the same sentence. They're literally almost the same film.
Yeah, they're interchangeable.
So, yes. Maybe like a double feature for an art appreciation course would be first watch Annie Hall and then do a comparative analysis with Balls of Fury. See that just the stark similarities between the two.
Yeah, I would. That's worth a master's degree, I would say, in some schools.
Absolutely.
In some schools.
I'm sure that'll be a course at NYU in the fall.
And the book. Let's not forget the book, Self-Inflicted Wounds. And I mean, I guess everyone has had a lot of self-inflicted wounds, but you seem to have had more than your fair share.
Sadly, the book is not even a comprehensive accounting of all of the ways that I've soiled the bed. But, I have a podcast called Grow on Guy where I talk mostly to men, not entirely to men, maybe, but about, I was raised by my father, a single dad, and just have always kind of been a guy's girl. And so the show is kind of an expression of that. But I talked to a lot of artists and writers and comedians and athletes about how they became the people they are now. And then at the end, they tell a self-inflicted wound story, which is a story of something that's gone wrong in your life that's your own fault. You cannot blame anyone. You'd like to blame your mother or your girlfriend or the man or Area 51, which we now know is real, but you cannot. You cannot blame these things. It's your fault. Area 51 did not throw shots down your throat and then get you to punch that bystander. And so everybody tells these stories, and it kind of humanizes these people who seem, you know, somebody like Chris Rock seems like he just fell from the sky, you know, brilliant and perfect, and then you realize he's made the same idiot mistakes that you made in college, only he made them a few weeks ago, and you have the excuse of the fact that you were in college. And it just humanizes these successful people. And so then after 2 years of forcing these people to come on my show and humiliate themselves, I thought it was only fair that I turned the tables on myself. And so it's a comprehensive, not comprehensive, as I said, accounting of my all the things I've done that were idiotic and boneheaded since I was five. But the point of the book is really that people come to me in my shows and my stand-up shows, and they'll say, you know, I'd love to be a stand-up comedian, but I'm afraid I'm going to fail. Or I'd like to write a book. I'm afraid I'm going to fail. I say, well, don't worry about failure. You are going to fail. You're going to scrub your butt on uncarpeted plywood. Get ready for that to happen. But don't let that keep you from doing something that you want to do. Failure, fear of failure should never keep you from following your dreams, because success is not the absence of failure. Success is persistence through failure and allowing bravery to drive you forward, and then embracing your failures and letting them teach you whatever they can teach you, which may just be don't stick your hand in a fire or put on pants before you leave the house, and let those failures make you a mentally and a creatively stronger person. So hopefully the book is just very fun and you'll laugh at what a ding-dong I've been, but hopefully also people will be inspired to get out there and make their own egregious and spectacular mistakes, and hopefully they'll avoid bodily injury.
So like, fear of failure should never prevent you from failing.
No, absolutely. You have encapsulated
you need to fail.
It perfectly.
Failure is good.
Failure is good because this life is quite brief, and if you let a fear of failing drive your choices, well, you'll just kind of stay inside in a padded room, won't you? And eating soft food with your hands, which can be a good time on the short scale, but over, you know, pudding just gets old and it gets under your fingernails, and you know. There's a lot of issues to deal with there.
Yeah, and for a comedian or for someone who wants to stand up or something like that, so much of that is useful in your premises and developing your premises.
Yeah.
And you speak of premises.
Yeah. Well, I always say that people don't want to be friends with the guy who comes running into a bar at 5:30 and says, "Hey guys, I nailed the presentation. I got a new corner office. I got a raise. I'm dating a model. Look at my suit. It's from Italy." Everybody wants to punch that guy in the neck, but everybody loves the guy who comes sprinting into the bar with one shoe and one bare foot, and they're damp, and their pockets are turned out, and they say, "Oh my God, I think I just set my car on fire." Everybody's like, "Oh, hey, sit down, let me buy you a beer, tell me about it." So that's absolutely true in comedy, that that honesty and divulgence are critical, and people want to know they can relate to you. And so the best stories, and every comedian, and I say this in the book, you know, most people want to hide their embarrassing stories, but comedians are the ones who come running into a party and go, "Oh my God, I am such a jackass. Let me tell you what I did." Everybody loves to tell that story. Well, comedians like to tell that story. Maybe other people go into therapy. But luckily for me, I get paid to have therapy on stage in front of the drinking audience, which I'm sure you can relate to quite specifically.
Which part of that?
Well, maybe not the drinking audience, though. I don't know how people get down in Wisconsin. They may all be totally intoxicated right now.
No, they're on coffee. It's public radio.
Yes, it is public radio.
Coffee and donuts.
But maybe they can be intoxicated on some kind of fair trade shade-grown coffee, which can be very intoxicating. You know, it's been strained through, unbleached filters by babies, by tiny babies who've only ever eaten organic food that was made by their mothers in a mortar and pestle. And that's its own kind of intoxication.
Hey, you hit that right on the head. There's nothing you said there that was wrong. But, I was thinking of these humiliations. Did you read the Bad Weather, Sarah Silverman's book?
The Bedwetter. No, I haven't read The Bedwetter, although I've just seen her wet the bed live, which is much more interesting.
But you know, because she said that the reason she got into comedy was the fact that she was a bedwetter. Because, that's sort of the ultimate humiliation for a kid or something to be a bedwetter.
Yeah, and I'm 6 feet tall, and I've been this tall since feel like preschool. Yeah. And I was also the only black kid in my school, and the only poor kid. My parents scraped and saved, and I'm sure sold blood, maybe a part of a liver, to send me to private school. And so I was the only black kid, the only poor kid. I was extraordinarily tall. My parents didn't believe in television, and they were vegetarians. So I had all of the factors to be super popular. And and what I realized now, looking back, it was just this kind of extended period of abject misery. But what I realized was that I became a comedian because when I was a kid, I would make fun of myself. I realized I'm going to make fun of myself faster and better than you could ever possibly do, with longer words and more complexity. And maybe I'm not going to be able to dance around myself in a circle holding hands. That's just physically impossible. But every other part of the mockery, I can handle on my own. And so that was probably where my comedic voice came from, was just, you know, self-deprecation was a defense mechanism. Mm-hmm. There's just nothing. First of all, during Black History, I was the only black kid in my school. So during Black History Month, I was the exhibit. They were like, here we have the Negro in her natural habitat, and she's going to tell us all about her people, and then we're going to touch her hair. But I was also a vegetarian, and I talk about this in the book, a big bonding activity for kids is, you know, you exchange lunches, and, nobody wants a brick of tofu. It is literally impossible to unload on the schoolyard. You cannot pay someone else to take your food from you when you have an avocado sandwich and a whole wheat fig Newton that's the size of a preteen's hand. So I was just a beggar. I was literally resorting to beggary in grade school, where it was just like, please, sir, may I have some more? I'll literally eat the crust of your bologna sandwich and just kind of let, not the actual bologna, but the aroma of bologna, because I know bologna touched the crust, let that wash over me. All of that added up to...
to what you are today.
To what I
to
am
all,
today.
All that you are. How did all that play at Dartmouth, though? When you, I mean, that's kind of a serious school, isn't it, Dartmouth?
Well, I was really bookish. That was the side effect of being a social pariah. I'll pour all my energy into learning stuff. Thank you.
Yeah.
I was also one of those weird kids who would go to the library for fun on a weekend. She's destined for greatness, or maybe for social isolation. And I would study a pathology book. That was my favorite thing to look at, was pathology books. Oh, yeah, good times. Goiters are always a good time. I mean, you can never get enough goiters. So, and I would just, like an inveterate reader. And then when I went to Dartmouth, it was quite a serious school. I was going to be an attorney, I thought. Oh. And then I realized that attorneys are not fun people to be around.
Right.
So, yeah, and you can't drink at work, and I can now with my comedy. But I married it. My husband became an attorney, which was plenty for one house. And, you know, someone's got to win all the arguments, so yeah. I give those up to him. But
in the science exhibit picture that's on the book cover, on the inner leaf.
Oh, that was me in the eighth grade.
In the eighth grade. What is your exhibit? I'm trying hard to see what
it was. Such a layup. I mean, it was the laziest science ever. Yeah. You know, I was a very studious kid, but I will say that I occasionally got casual. So in the eighth grade, I spent a year in public school, and I was a little bit ahead of everybody. And so I came up with the worst, laziest – I mean, anybody who's either got a kid doing science or remembers this from grade school. I did whether artificial light or natural sunlight produced – which was more effective in producing photosynthesis and plant growth. I mean, it's just the lazy. I just got a light bulb, and I opened the window. I mean, you know, and then I put my feet up and you know, read The Hobbit for the 17th time. Yeah. I mean, what a lazy bastard. Yeah, but I did win.
Okay, but you got a red ribbon on it, though, I see.
I did. I've got a ribbon there. If you notice, I've also got glasses that can both see into the future and burn ants with the rays of the sun, and a beautiful Casio watch, because if I had hoped to fit in, that was just a guarantee that I would not. But I could calculate some things for you, some small, simple calculations on my wrist.
Do you still have
the precursor of my obsession with my iPhone? You can see it in that picture.
Yeah. Do you still have the dress? Pictured here.
Oh, that dress! No, that dress has been burned. Yeah. That dress has been burned, and then I.
And that was a ploy.
I urinated it, and then I flung it to the street.
You what?
Yeah, there's a picture for people who are listening in the book of me wearing them.
It's a remarkable dress.
It's unacceptable. It's an unacceptable dress. This was a period of time when I blame the chapter is all about how I blame Jennifer Lopez for this really dark nadir in our fashion history in America, where she wore that plunging dress and everybody lost their minds. People were running into traffic and puppies and kittens were making out. Everybody just went crazy. And so every stylist was thinking that they needed their client to have some kind of splashy dress on the carpet. So my stylist picked this dress for me. It is barely a dress. It's more of kind of an abstract concept with straps. And it just, it's so offensive. I would literally, if I could go back in time, I would punch myself in the face for wearing that dress.
I bet you would.
I would do it. I would go up and I would slap myself and then I would put myself into rehab for poor choices.
Yeah. But that was a ploy. Wasn't that a ploy to get, because you were on a red carpet.
I was on a red carpet. A lot of people took a picture of it, much in the way that a lot of people might take pictures of a two-headed dog, just an oddity. And unfortunately, as we all have hopefully realized by this point in our lives, the internet is forever. So long after this civilization and all the ones to follow have risen and fallen, and the world is covered in vegetation and pools of water, and cockroaches log in to the internet using their iPhone 273, there will be a picture of that dress on the internet. It will never die. I cannot.
Give you some idea of what we're talking about here.
It's upsetting.
It was very, very effective from a...
Oh, it's amazing my mother has lived through seeing that with her own eyes.
Yeah.
Because I think that could be enough to give a mother palpitations. It's the worst.
But a red carpet thing, I mean, that's at that point in your career, it's sort of important to draw some attention, no matter what
sort. Yeah. That was the thinking. That was the thinking. It always makes sense at the time, doesn't it? When you wake up in the morning and your head's pounding and you're in a car trunk, you think, well, maybe it doesn't make sense. But the night before when you got into the car trunk, it seemed to make perfect sense. Cozy, warm, right? Yes, enclosed.
And for people who want to do stand-up or comedian, you actually give some interesting instructions here. Not instructions so much, but as what to expect, I guess. Because there are people who want to go out there, and once again, they're afraid of flopping. And the answer is, you will flop, right? No matter what you do.
Yes. Oh, I love when people ask. One of my favorite questions when I do interviews is when people say, "So have you ever bombed?" Which I think is hilarious, like akin to, "Have you ever had a glass of water or engaged in this thing called sleep?" Of course, I've bought thousands of times, innumerable times.
Yeah.
You literally cannot become a funny person without bombing, because killing doesn't make you funny. When you have a great set, you just go home, you drop the mic and, you know, go buy everybody shots and, you know, fall asleep clutching yourself if affectionately. But when you bomb, that's when you go back and you reexamine every single life choice you've made up until that point. And try to get better, you know, and realize I've got to do more. I've got to write. I've got to. And so bombing is what makes you mentally tough. It's what makes you creatively tough. It makes you fearless. And so, you know, early in your career, you know, you get up and you get a laugh or two and you think you're, you know, next coming of Richard Pryor or Eddie Murphy, which every comedian thinks they are. Every single comedian thinks, oh, Richard Pryor. I'm going to be the next Richard Pryor. Here it comes. And then you just spend the next 5 to 10 years of your life just pretty much in various states of suckage, and it's bewildering, and it really does weed out the wheat from the chaff, and maybe the mentally healthy people from the people addicted to self abuse, because you just have to plow through that for years, and you'll have moments of transcendence and then periods of just abject humiliation that you've chosen for yourself, but. There's just no way around it. It's like being an athlete. You just have to keep getting out on the track, and you have to keep running, and then you slowly get faster, and then you get on the track at the Olympics, and then Usain Bolt smokes the crap out of you and crushes your dreams. But you're still fast. You're just not fast enough.
So, and then finally, you get to the point where you can actually do corporate stand-up, right?
Oh,
the height of everything?
So I have a chapter in the book about why I'll never do another corporate gig, which I say to myself every time I do a corporate gig, and then I forget immediately when I take another corporate gig. But that was really engendered by a very specific corporate gig I did in Atlanta for a very large big box corporation. Mm-hmm. And it was like, have you ever seen a movie where all of a sudden the main character has this moment where they look up and there's like a ringing in their ears and everything is silent? and things have gone down to slow motion, and there's this kind of like film of surreality over. That's the feeling I get every time I walk out onto stage in front of people, and it's 9:15 in the morning, and they're eating, you know, some kind of terrible Danish that's come from the bowels of a giant hotel, and they don't want to be there, and they don't know who you are, and they've just had a weekend of being pummeled by their higher-ups, and maybe like the HR person's next to them, so they're not going to laugh at anything, because they're surely to garner some kind of HR seminar later about what's appropriate and harassment and sexual innuendo. So I literally cannot tell any jokes. So it just becomes this kind of long-form spoken word piece where I try to skirt around anything interesting or provocative, and we're all just with our eyes on the clock, just literally. It's like a scene from Risky Business where the clock is ticking, and then it actually ticks backwards, and then I cry out and fall to my knees like Willem Dafoe at the end of Full Metal Jacket. I mean, I can't bear them. They're misery. And no one ever laughs because they're afraid the boss is going to think that they're human beings who have feelings and ideas.
Yeah.
So there's no laughter. Also,
yeah.
People must be drunk.
Yeah.
People must be drunk for comedy to work. I forgot to put that out there. I should have led with that. I buried my lead.
It helps.
Mm. It really does. I always tell people, we'll all like each other a lot better when you are intoxicated. So if you could just move a little quicker with the shots, it would be good for everyone here.
But you know, Woody Allen also in that same movie says something, which I think he believed, that he hated performing in front of people who are stoned, you know, on a college campus, because that's a cheap, they'd be laughing anyway, you know. So he didn't.
Oh, absolutely.
Didn't earn
Why
a laugh.
Not?
But
yeah,
I
get it. Well, you know, he likes to suffer.
Yeah.
I prefer to kill. No, I mean, the main thing, the main requirement, I think, for comedy is that people are excited to be there, and people are never excited to be at a corporate retreat.
No.
It's just something you tolerate, unless you're hooking up with, you know, one of your coworkers, and then there's this kind of penny taste of shame in your mouth because you didn't pick up your phone the night before when your family members called you. But generally, no one wants to be at a corporate retreat. They don't want to be watching comedy. They want everything to be over. But in a club, people are excited to be there. They're all facing forward. I mean, your audience comes. They are coming to see you. They're so excited about what do you know. They love the show. So they're ready to be delighted. I mean, you still have to delight them. They're a tough crowd. You guys know you're a tough crowd in there. Right?
Yeah.
You parse every joke. Oh, you listen. You think about it. You do like a diagram in your head. This seems ridiculous.
Yeah.
Is this farce? I don't know. Did that really happen?
Yeah.
And then you respond. But
you know, I did a Kotex thing one time. I mean, it was.
Did you?
It was a Kotex corporate thing, or the people who made Kotex, but the company.
What
I did? I cut up their product. I made a male Kotex. I cut it into jock straps and brought that, and things like that.
I held it up. Extraordinary initiative. I love that. I already love what you did.
Oh, it was a terrible idea, and it just sat there. I mean, the guy who invented the sanitary pad was there or something. I didn't get a single laugh at all. It was horrible.
Mr. Kotex was there?
Well, the people, you know. Yeah, the scientists
and
behind it.
And here's the thing, right? There's just no way they can laugh at their own product. People in corporate settings never have a sense of humor. They're too worried that they're going to get a write-up in their file.
Yeah. That was my last corporate gig. That was some years ago. So.
I have to tell you something. From one comedian to another, that I would have taken the Kotex gig just for the story, just so I could say, I could run to my friends and go, oh, my God, I did a Kotex gig. It was literally like being on my period. That's what it felt like.
That's what I should have said. I didn't. If I would have been Aisha Tyler, I would have said it. Thank you so much, Aisha. It's been great talking with you. It's a pleasure and
God,
an honor.
What a pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
And all those things.
What a thrill.
I
listen to you every week. How exciting to be speaking to you.
Sweet of
you.
If you don't get enough of Aisha Tyler, you can get the book as well, because she's everywhere, but you might want to read about it too. Self-Inflicted Wounds is the book. Thank you, Aisha.
Yes, thank you, guys. Thanks
great,
for
great
having
talking
me.
To you.
Aisha Tyler.
Okay. Food for thought.
We did another corporate gig after the...
Which one was that?
Well, we went to Arizona that time. And,
oh, yeah.
Yeah.
TRW, wasn't it?
Yeah.
The Gears guys.
Yeah. That wasn't great either. It was okay.
No,
it seemed
hard
kind
to do
of subdued.
Gears. They made Gears and stuff. But then they were also in financing.
Yeah.
So it was hard to bridge that gap in terms of humor. And it was, it didn't make any difference anyway. They don't care. All right. So corporate gigs are out. Are you doing pretty good there?
Yes. I'd forgotten that one.
Yeah.
Because I think I was there too.
Yes.
You drug me along. Yeah.
Okay, anyhow then, what you got for us here, a little surprise?
This is called Last Time I Saw Paris.
Oh, yes. Remember it?